Gentrification is something people all over America are talking about, and that includes Kansas City, from the West Side to Strawberry Hill, from the historic Northeast to East Brookside. Neighborhoods are changing. Coffee shops and craft breweries are moving in. Houses are getting fresh new paint jobs. But who lived and worked in those neighborhoods before? Are they still around? And if not, why not? The answers run a lot deeper than we might think. Peter Moskowitz is the author of How to Kill a City: Gentrification, Inequality, and the Fight for the Neighborhood. He's traveled all over the country meeting people who have been pushed out or suddenly feel like strangers in the places that used to be home. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and Peter is on the line with us now. Hi, Peter.
Hi, how are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Define gentrification and give us like a little bit of the history of the word and how we use it.
Sure. So, gentrification doesn't necessarily have a precise definition. Everyone who uses the word might use it a little differently. One thing it can mean is the kind of displacement of one group of people based on the moving in of another group of people, and that's kind of what you talked about at the intro of the show. You know, these new mustachioed hipsters moving in, and all of a sudden the neighborhood is completely changed, and the old people are gone. It can also mean to me a city prioritizing certain groups of people over others, whether or not those other people are actually displaced. So if you look at New York or Detroit, where tax breaks are being given to corporations to move in to downtown, and at the same time in Detroit, for example, garbage service is being cut to the poorest neighborhoods. To me, that's gentrification because it prioritizes a richer group of people over a poorer group of people.
Can you spell out a little bit more the relationship between that prioritization and what people see with their eyes that usually signals gentrification? Like usually you were saying, like you see this group of people moving in and you say, oh, yep, there it is. What's the relationship between that sort of changing of the guard in a particular neighborhood and that larger scale prioritization of one group over another?
Yeah, and this really goes back to the whole history of gentrification and how we came to the kind of definition we have now. If you go back to the 70s, researchers put gentrification into four phases. And the first phase is kind of that organic, quote unquote, bottom-up version of gentrification, where artists and hippies and other creative types are moving into neighborhoods and fixing up houses on their own. The second phase is more when it gets to the small business level, and then the third and fourth phases are more when corporations take over, when you have banks buying up whole blocks of housing, and developers being the only ones who can really afford to gentrify a neighborhood anymore. Like if you look at New York or San Francisco now, even if you have $1 million, you can't really afford to buy much real estate. So the only people, quote unquote, gentrifying a neighborhood are those with access to lots and lots of capital. But to your point about what precedes all that, in my book, I kind of argue that there's always a stage zero of gentrification, and that's when a government does that reprioritization, when it decides to open up a city to gentrification. And that can take many forms. It can take the form of the government cutting off certain neighborhoods from services. It can take the form of tax breaks for a new stadium or a corporation to move downtown, using state or city money to help a corporation instead of, let's say, a local school system or public transit. It can happen over many decades, and it's kind of, there are all these ways that this reprioritization has been built into U.S. policy, whether it's through, how mortgages are accessed or the ways in which cities are funded from the federal level. I don't know how much into the nitty-gritty you want to go, but there, in my opinion, there's always this kind of stage zero when the government says, okay, we want a certain kind of people in this city or a certain level of wealth in the city, and here's how we're going to do it.
And that will sometimes apply to one pocket of the city or one group of people who have plans to come in and make changes, that you could look at a neighborhood very nearby and see not that same level of attention given.
Right, exactly. And usually it affects certain neighborhoods first, but it's often a policy for the whole city. So Detroit, again, is a great example of this. Right now, the downtown and midtown sections, which are often called the 7.2 because it's 7.2 square miles, and Detroit is something like 150 square miles in total. So it's this very small area relatively to the rest of the city. Those are the only sections that are really seeing lots of new development, that are seeing new people moving in, that are seeing new high rises going up, and studio and one bedroom apartments renting for $1,500, which 10 years ago was unheard of in Detroit. So even though it's only those two neighborhoods that are really being affected at this point, the policy is really applied to the whole city in terms of what's prioritized, i.e., what corporations are given money, who's given tax breaks, what developers are allowed to build higher than they were in the past, and what types of people are essentially deprioritized, the people who live in neighborhoods without streetlights and regular garbage service or an adequate police presence. So even though you only see the effects, that if you're driving through and say, oh, this is gentrification, there's the craft beer place and there's the fancy bag store or whatever, you only see it in a few neighborhoods, but it's really a policy that's applied writ large to the entire city.
A lot of people will look at the sort of obvious repairs and just like potholes being fixed or something like that that come with gentrification. And then they'd say, well, why isn't this a good thing? Can you pa unpack that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's nothing wrong with potholes being repaired. And even, anti-gentrification activists aren't against, new parks and improvements to public transit and those kinds of things. But I think unfortunately, the way that our cities operate, those amenities become tools for real estate development, and that inevitably displaces people. And the neighborhood I grew up in New York is a perfect example of that. I grew up in the West Village, which in Manhattan, downtown Manhattan. And when I was growing up, it was this mixed income neighborhood that a lot of artists and young professionals lived in. And it was just a great neighborhood to grow up in. And it was also the same neighborhood that Jane Jacobs, one of the most famous urbanists, wrote her book, The Death and Life of Great American Cities, in. And she wrote that the West Village was great because it had all of these things we're talking about, these small streets, these cute small businesses, these little parks and tree-lined streets, and access to public transportation. And if you go to the West Village now, it's completely changed. It's filled mostly with millionaires. The average price for a one-bedroom apartment is $3,500 a month. It's essentially become this kind of playground for the uber rich, and no one, including me, who makes a moderate amount of money, can afford to live there anymore. And that's precisely because it has all those amenities that made it a great place to grow up, and the same amenities that Jane Jacobs wrote about. So it's not that those are inherently a bad thing, but unfortunately, in this society where essentially money buys you access to those amenities often end up pricing people out, and that puts people in the unfortunate conundrum where they want to improve their neighborhood, but they're also scared to because they know that that'll eventually put more pressure on their neighborhood. And, I talked to someone in San Francisco when I was reporting this book, who she's Latina and she's a neighborhood activist, and she used to go to, every tree planting day and every community event, and she would be the one picking up litter from her sidewalks. And then she told me she felt like she was taking the smallpox blankets that she thought she was being helped or helping her neighborhood, but really what she was doing was making it more attractive for rich white people to move into it. And that's not a situation she wanted to be in. She wanted to to be able to improve her neighborhood, but that's just kind of how the system works these days.
Yeah, can you take me back to your own experience a little bit? Because you write about that in the introduction of the book, and you experienced gentrification in the sense that you were sort of not able to resettle as an adult in the neighborhood where you had grown up, but you also experienced gentrification as a gentrifier at that point.
Yes, exactly. And that's kind of why I wanted to write this book. As I said, I grew up in the West Village, and I kind of have this idealized image of it now that I'm an adult, and I feel like I took it for granted as a kid. But it was this place where I could walk to school alone when I was in fifth grade because, there were people along the route that I knew, and it was just this great walkable community, and, so many of my friends lived there, and there were so many families that had been there for decades upon decades. I went away to college, and fortunately my parents were able to buy in that neighborhood, in the early 1980s when the only thing on their block besides their apartment building was some garbage truck parking garages. So they bought a place for very cheap. And that's how they're able to stay there. But I went away to college, I came back and, looked around, and all of a sudden I said, where did my neighborhood go? What happened to it? The small stores were gone, the independent shops replaced by things like Marc Jacobs and Gucci and Ralph Lauren all along this corridor, Bleecker Street. All my neighbors were gone. My parents are one of, I think, three original families left in the building out of 27. And my parents' new next door neighbor is a war contractor. The neighbor upstairs is a investment banker, very different types of people. And as I said, the average rent for the West Village now is $3,500 for a one bedroom. And as I'm sure you know, journalism is not the best paying career.
So yeah, $3,000 a month. Although I am actually surprised to hear it's not even higher than that just because of how I think of New York and the West Village. But yeah, that does sound high nonetheless.
Yeah, I mean, that's the average. So it probably is pushed downward by the fact that there are still rent-controlled apartments in the West Village that are renting for much cheaper than that. But yeah, for a market-rate apartment, you could easily be paying $5,000, $6,000, $7,000 a month. So I moved back. I obviously couldn't afford to live in the West Village anymore. And I ended up moving first to Queens and then to Brooklyn, and realized that, I was kind of on the exact opposite side of this now. I would walk down the street and I'd see, older residents of the neighborhood kind of give me this scowling look. And I might've thought it was rude if I hadn't been the one giving the scowling look in my old neighborhood. So I realized that I was this new presence that signified something kind of dangerous and terrible to people in this new neighborhood. And meanwhile, I was reading about gentrification in mainstream publications like the New York Times, and I wasn't seeing any explanation for how this was really happening.
It gets treated like something that's inevitable, and you write about this a lot, but is it? I mean, even you, who you're saying like you didn't want to be doing that to somebody else, but yet there you were.
Exactly. And in a way, it is inevitable. I mean, and we can talk about this later in the conversation. There are many ways to challenge it. But the reason gentrification often happens is because, a middle class person like me will move into the closest neighborhood they can afford to a center of a city. And that inevitably displaces people because there's not adequate affordable housing. But the way it's presented in the mainstream media often makes it seem not only inevitable, but also extremely mysterious. I think the New York Times is kind of the worst at this. They, especially when gentrification was becoming part of the public conversation, you'd see these articles about where the next Brooklyn or where the next Williamsburg would be, or, why hipsters love XYZ neighborhood, or how, downtown Detroit or New Orleans was experiencing a experiencing a resurgence, and lots of people were moving down there. And nowhere would you see in the pages of the Times or many other mainstream publications the other side of that. First of all, you wouldn't see the people who were displaced because of that. You wouldn't see the kind of increased pressures that gentrification put on people who are able to stay, whether that means paying more of their money and rent, whether it means they can't afford to grocery shop in the neighborhood anymore.
You know, I want tell me a little bit more about that. Like, maybe start off by telling us what you, I guess, almost in a way, didn't witness in New Orleans. That was that the first place you went?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I just want to say one more thing about the media's role, which is just that they also didn't present any of the kind of reasons behind it. You know, it was as if people were just moving to downtowns for no reason, that, you know, there wasn't government policy, there wasn't economic factors, there wasn't overarching reasons that could explain why this was happening in every city. And that's why I wanted to travel to these other places, to show that this isn't just about New York, it's not just about San Francisco, it's really affecting every city in the United States.
Well, this might be a good time for me to say, you know, if you out there have a story to share about gentrification in a Kansas City neighborhood, or a question or observation about your role in what's happening, call 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. So I was just asking you about New Orleans, and the reason is that you were just mentioning that you didn't see included in other stories about gentrification the people being pushed out. And
right.
So talk to me about what you discovered in New Orleans.
And that's one of the really tricky things about gentrification and noticing it and reporting on it is, one, it's hard to report on something that is the lack of something. If someone is pushed out of a neighborhood and you come there a year later, how do you know that person was pushed out? How do you interview them? Where did they go? That makes it very difficult. And the other thing that makes it difficult is gentrification and redevelopment, in a way, erases neighborhood memory. You know, someone who comes to the West Village now says, oh, wow, this is a pretty neighborhood, and it's so expensive, but it's, you know, fun to get brunch in. They might not know that the neighborhood was a place that was supportive to the working class 30 years ago. If I go to Kansas City and I go to, you know, whatever neighborhood might have new restaurants in it, I might say, oh, this is a cute place. But I'm not going to know what it took to get there and the negative consequences of that. So that makes telling the full story of gentrification really, really hard. And I saw this most starkly in New Orleans because Hurricane Katrina essentially provided an opportunity for the government to gentrify the city. And it would sound like a conspiracy if it wasn't so clearly laid out in the opinion pages of newspapers at the time and in the quotes from politicians at the time. But the governor, Kathleen Blanco, who was governor in 2005 when Katrina hit, said it took the storm of a lifetime to create the opportunity of a lifetime. And she went about closing down every single public school in New Orleans and firing every unionized teacher in the New Orleans public school. And that union was a bastion for the black middle class of the city. The vast majority of the teachers were black. And those teachers were mostly replaced with white Teach for America volunteers who had come down from the north to volunteer after the storm. They also demolished every single unit of public housing in the city, even though many of them were not actually touched by the storm, and replaced them with privatized mixed income housing. And they, you know, there were also more subtle things, like it was found that FEMA systemically gave less money to black families to rebuild than white families. So at the end of the day, New Orleans is now at its pre-storm population again of about 450,000 people. And if you listen to the city leaders talk about New Orleans, they'll talk about it as a great success story. It's richer now than it was before Katrina. You know, just as many people live there as before Katrina. The streets are being repaired and new businesses are moving in. But there are also 100,000 out of 450,000, 100,000 fewer African Americans living in New Orleans today. And no one has really tracked where they went. So that when I learned that stat, that was kind of just jaw-dropping to me, how that could have just been swept under the rug, this story of people essentially being forcibly displaced first by a natural disaster, but then by a very man-made process of kind of ensuring that they didn't return.
Which really puts a sinister note to something. I mean, you write about that the when you first arrived in the neighborhood you were staying in, you commented to someone on how nice it was, and the response was, "Thank God for Katrina. That really helped clean this place up."
Right. Right. Yeah, and people, you know, David Brooks, the New York Times columnist at the time, wrote a column, it was just about a week after Katrina, saying, why would we let this city go back to the way it was? You know, it was poor before, it was crime ridden before. If we let these people return, it's just going to return to that. So why would we let that happen? And, you know, it wasn't some secret, you know, smoke filled room kind of thing. It was really a concerted effort to whiten New Orleans and make it richer. But the thing is that it doesn't have to be that blatant. And that's what I found in places like Detroit or in New York in the 1970s when it went through its near bankruptcy. It doesn't have to be someone saying, we're not going to allow certain races back into the city or we're going to push them out. The metaphor I like to use is back when the federal highway system was built, and you know, everyone of a certain age I'm sure remembers this, when these highways were kind of rammed through the center of cities, often how the government would determine where to put those highways is where the lowest tax bracket of a city was. And the thinking was, one, they would have less political power. The poorest residents would have less political power to say no to a highway being rammed through their neighborhood. And then even more kind of nefariously, if they could get rid of the people living in that neighborhood, if they rammed a highway through a poor black neighborhood, let's say, then all of a sudden the city would have less of a tax burden. They would have to provide fewer public services for those people, fewer public schools and less public transit. And that's how highways were ran through a lot of these poor black neighborhoods. You can think of gentrification in the same way in many ways. It's a way to economically alter neighborhoods of a city in a more subtle way than a highway, but nonetheless extremely and unfortunately effective.
When KCUR Central Standard returns from a short break, we are going to be hearing from you about gentrification in your Kansas City neighborhood. Share your story with Peter Moskowitz, author of How to Kill a City, right after this break. I'm Gina Kaufman. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard, and we're talking about gentrification with Peter Moskowitz. He's the author of How to Kill a City. People are getting together in neighborhoods throughout the metro through a group called Surge that's showing up for racial justice. They're talking about how to come up with action steps using this book to prevent gentrifying forces from just taking over here at home, which is really interesting to me. And it made us all here at the station and at Central Standard think that this was a good conversation to invite our listeners in on with the author of this book. So you can call 816-235-2888 to be a part of that conversation. Hi again, Peter.
Hi.
Do these kinds of discussion groups pop up in a lot of cities?
Yeah, I think people are really starting to see housing as a political issue. And I think one of the unfortunate things about gentrification is that it can often overcomplicate and kind of make the conversation overly academic if we're talking about percentage increase in cost of living and everything. But really what we're talking about is making housing a political issue. And this affects everyone, not just those living in gentrifying cities. You know, the cost of housing has risen tremendously over the last decade. Renters are being squeezed in suburbs, in rural communities, in cities. People who are having trouble paying their mortgages, that's becoming a more frequent scenario all the time. As compared to many other countries, we really don't have a housing-based political movement. If you remember the 2016 election, Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders, Donald Trump, none of them really had a housing platform. None of them mentioned housing in any of the debates, even though it's basically every American's number one expense, number one thing that they spend, you know, sometimes up to half of their money on, if not more, which is becoming increasingly common. So if you look to other countries like Germany, let's say, there are protests practically every month over the cost of living and housing, and that's true in many other places. So I've been really heartened to see that people are starting to come to the conclusion that we need to build political movements around housing, and I think that's just starting. I think we're really at square one where people are becoming aware of the housing crisis. They're becoming aware that, you know, maybe it's not fair that we spend 50% of our money on rent, and starting to build movements around that.
Let's talk to Jean, who is calling us from Belton. Hi, Jean.
Hey, Gina.
What do you want to share?
First of all, I love the title of his book. That is amazing, because that is what you see happen, and it is sad to see people get displaced. I wanted to tell a story that I've had experience down in what they consider Center City part of the city, which is basically the Truce Corridor, and especially between 31st and Linwood. That area has been building by building being reinvested into, and it's beginning to come up like, you know, other areas of the city already have. And the government, of course, is supporting that development with TIFs and that sort of thing. And there's
It's
not much you
tax
can do
increment
about that.
financing. So,
Right.
yeah.
So they, yeah. So, you know, there's a whole trade-off in the way you do it to in order to get those benefits. And there's really not a whole lot you can do when that starts to happen. And I happen to know the people that are on the corner of 31st and Truce, the Reconciliation Services team. And if you ever want to know anything about that area, go to Father Justin Matthews because he knows the history of that area. And it is so interesting. And I really think that if we as community members want to do things, like I said, there's not a lot we can do about it being
Jean,
turned over
can
in
I jump in?
gentrification.
Can I jump
Yeah.
in? Because our guest today, you know, is not from Kansas City, and I wonder if you can just quickly describe to him some of the change that you're seeing in this neighborhood so that
Okay.
maybe he can respond to what you're describing.
Okay, so that area a long time ago used to be a plantation. And it was owned by a Methodist minister, and then it became Magnificent Mile or Millionaire's Mile or something like that, where all the big, huge homes were built for the wealthier people of Kansas City. And then at some point, that moved out and Truce went downhill. And it has been the dividing line for our city, but I
A
think
racial
now it's,
dividing line.
Right.
yeah,
And
and
I
it's
assume
kind of
that it went
moving out.
downhill during the period of kind of white flight experienced in many
Yeah,
cities in the 60s,
exactly,
70s.
exactly.
Okay, so
And
we're.
they also moved 71, Highway 71, so that it kind of instead of, I mean, they built 71 so that it went around the, you didn't have to go through that part of the town.
Yeah, I'm
You could
gonna,
just take the
Jean, I'm gonna
zippity-doo
let
dot
our guest,
downtown.
I'm gonna let our guest respond to this, just letting him know that there is now, as you might imagine, some renewed interest in.
Right.
Intrused from the larger community and
And
things are
yeah, I mean,
changing
this is
again.
how it's such a perfect example of how this process nearly always works. But, you know, this period of white flight that we think of as some kind of natural phenomenon based on crime or, you know, people wanting bigger suburban homes or whatever, it was actually a concerted effort by the federal government to enrich white people by gifting them mortgages. If you've heard of the term redlining, you know, the federal government would literally draw lines on maps saying we won't lend to, we won't insure mortgages for people who live in these neighborhoods. And that calculation was based explicitly on how many African Americans lived in that neighborhood. And so what that essentially did was, if anyone wanted to own a home, they had to go to these new nearly all white communities outside of city centers, and that caused a huge dive in real estate values and wealth in inner cities like this neighborhood you're talking about. Fast forward to today, it's often those very same neighborhoods that are now the ones being gentrified because the seesaw has kind of tipped in the other direction. You have this neighborhood that went from rich to as poor as it could be, and now you have real estate investors looking at it and saying, there's tremendous real estate value here. We can buy up this property for very cheap and sell it for 10 times as much. And because it's in this neighborhood that's close to the city center, that has many amenities that people used to be attracted to, we can essentially make it rich again. But the kind of injustice of that to me is that the people who are living there don't get any of that new wealth usually.
Let's talk to Sydney in Midtown. Hi, Sydney.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. How are you?
Oh, pretty good.
Tell me your story.
Okay. My story, I'm a little nervous, but I'll try to do the best I can. My story is I started out talking about Parade Park, which is a housing development off of 18th Street, one area, 18th and Woodland in that region, and it's, you know, housing development.
One of the oldest in the country.
It seems. What did you say?
One of the oldest in the country.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I have a sister that lives there now. My mother lived there prior to that. I'm over 65, so we're from this area. And Parade Park, I think, is beginning to experience regentrification. From what my sister's telling me, they're trying to sell, to buy off that housing development. So, and also I wanted to mention that in that same area there is a park. There used to be a park. Now they have built a baseball field or something like that over there in Prairie Park. And it used to be a walking area for people. They could just go to the park and walk. Now they've tore all that down and put it in a sports place for children and adolescents. So, I mean, that's good, but they could have done it somewhere else rather than take over the community's park.
You know, how does this all feel to you and your mom and your sister?
Well, my mother's now deceased,
but my
sister is really experiencing a hard time. She's trying to find somewhere else to live. Because evidently she knows more of the details about it, but she has been going to meetings about how they're planning on redeveloping, or you know, someone wants to buy Prairie Park.
Let's let
and
our guest,
like you said, it's one of the oldest co-ops, you know.
Let's let our guest respond to some of this. I'm sorry you guys are dealing with that, Peter. What do you hear in Sydney's story? Specifically with housing projects.
Yeah, I think it's a really unfortunate story, and it's part of this much larger trend of the federal government really disinvesting in all public benefits, but especially in housing. If you go back to the 1970s, the top tax rate on the wealthiest Americans at the federal level was in the high 70%, and now it's closer to 30%. So the federal government has many billions fewer dollars today than it did decades ago because of how low taxes are. And what that means is that even under Democratic presidents like Obama and Clinton, you saw a huge diminishment of public housing. Bill Clinton he implemented this program called Hope 6 that essentially encouraged cities to demolish as much public housing as possible and replace it with mixed income housing. But it was never a one-to-one replacement. So you have many, many fewer thousand units of public housing in most cities now. And the housing that does exist in most cities, even rich ones like San Francisco and New York, is constantly underfunded, constantly in need of repair. And, you know, it's kind of the oldest trick in the book that governments pull. They underfund things. They don't give them adequate repairs. And then they say, look, it's not working. It's filled with, mold, or it's, falling apart. We can't keep funding this. And it's only because there was a deliberate choice not to maintain it in the first place.
You know, I know you have to hurry off somewhere, but I really want to get another caller in on this, because I think this gets to the question that a lot of people are asking themselves. And that's the question that Kyle in Kansas City has to ask. Hi, excuse me, Lyle.
Hi there, guys.
Hi.
Hi.
So I've got a sort of the opposite side of this scenario, and trying to think about how I've witnessed gentrification in Wicker Park in Chicago. I was one of the white people moving into a more diverse neighborhood, and I witnessed some of it in Hollywood. Now I'm back in Kansas City, and my job skills and my wife's job skills kind of, I mean, I'm a carpenter by trade, and she's an interior designer, and we've got a financial situation where, you know, the stock market's got to go down. We do have, we're fortunate, obviously, this is an incredibly right. fortunate thing. To buy houses and rehab them would be the best use of our skills. And so what do you suggest to someone like us that has the financial ability to make this happen? And you know, obviously it would be better for our family, but as a person that's trying to be conscious of the effects on the general society, mm-hmm. what are my choices?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are a couple of things. There's always the option to keep rents in those houses low or sell them to lower income people. One of the most interesting mechanisms I've seen is called a community land trust, where people get together and essentially create a nonprofit, and they'll put housing into that nonprofit. So, you know, let's say you find two houses next to each other that are in need of repair. You could make one market rate and then put the other into the community land trust so that it could be rented in perpetuity for essentially the cost of the mortgage or the cost of the repairs.
Can I ask, beyond Lyle's specific question, what can people who are sort of like cogs in this wheel do? I mean, is there something that an individual person can do in their own decision making that doesn't just make this inevitable, as you were saying?
I don't think there's a way to kind of individually choose your way out of gentrification. You know, we're all part of the system. It's these forces that are much larger than us. So I don't think buying in a certain neighborhood or saying hi to your neighbor, you know, all those things can be great considerations, but they're not going to solve the problem. And really what is political action. And I encourage everyone every time I have a conversation to do this, Google your city and the word gentrification or the word housing and read some news articles, and you will inevitably find groups that have been working on these issues for years and years, even before, you know, it was called gentrification. You'll still find an affordable housing group or a neighborhood group and join them. I mean, that's all you can do. None of us have the expertise on our own to challenge this. It's better to follow the people who have been leading this movement for years and get on board.
Peter Moskowitz, author of How to Kill a City, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Serge Casey is hosting discussions about the book in Kansas City, all over the metro. Tonight's event is at 6 at the Northeast Branch of the Public Library. I'm Gina Kaufman, KCUR's Central Standard. We'll be right back. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard. And now a new show at The Rep is opening this weekend. It's called The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime. And it's all about a 15-year-old boy who is extremely intelligent, but really struggles with some of the aspects of ordinary day-to-day life. And I'm here with the actor who plays that character, Jamie Sanders. He is an actor with Tourette syndrome who is an outspoken advocate for people with Tourette syndrome. Hi, Jamie.
How you doing?
Tell me about your character.
Well, Christopher is, like you said, very intelligent, but he does struggle specifically because he has some form of autism. They keep it kind of vague, which I think is a smart idea because it is kind of more about the experience of having autism.
Rather than the label.
Exactly, yeah, and the way that the world reacts to him. So this is very much a show that is told through the lens of Christopher, and his lens is very mathematical. He loves math. Or maths, as he says, because he has English. And he has a pet rat called Toby, and that's how he kind of shows affection. But everything is kind of, everything that you would think a teenager would be interested in, he kind of turns on its head. So he's very into the academics. He's not very social. He's very much an introverted kid who is relatable and just like everyone else, but not just like everyone else.
Yeah. I mean, do you relate to Christopher from your own experience?
Absolutely. I think there are certain commonalities that anyone who is mentally different has experienced. You know, with Christopher, he will yell if someone touches him. There are multiple points in the show where I just have to very loudly shout because someone has brushed up against me or grabbed me or in any way touched me, which, you know, obviously most people wouldn't do that, and it leads to a lot of dirty stares. For me, you know, I'm used to getting stared at on the subway, or, for example, I've walked through the park at night and thought no one is around, so I start ticking a little bit, you know, a little, and I realize then a homeless man has sat up and has given me a dirty look.
So talk to me about, I mean, how did you come to understand that you had Tourette's syndrome?
Well, I was in, I think, end of second, beginning of third grade, and I was making noises at night when my mom was reading to me, and my mom would stop and be like, yes, and I'd be like, no, it's just a thing I do. That's a pretty common one for kids who are just about to be diagnosed with Tourette's, is it's just a thing I do. So look for that if your kid is making noises and saying that. Maybe go see someone. But then we went to talk to our guidance counselor. This was actually just post 9/11, and we were a few blocks away at my school. I went to PS 150, and so the city had sent special counselors to work with the kids.
And the city being New York.
Yes, New York City. Sorry.
Oh, no.
The city. Yes, it's the city, please. But yeah, so they sent in a bunch of special counselors, and one of those counselors happened to be a close associate and friend of Dr. Barbara Coffey, who just so happens to be one of the leading experts on Tourette's in, I don't know about the world, but definitely the United States of America. And so she referred me to her. I went to Dr. Coffey. By the end of one meeting with Dr. Coffey, she was like, oh, yeah, that is Tourette syndrome. Yes.
So what? How did that shape your experience at when you were around the age that your character is, around 15 or so?
Well, I simultaneously pulled into myself and became substantially more vocal. Because when you are inadvertently blurting things or making noises or making yourself a center of attention, you can't necessarily afford to be quiet. And I was always friendly.
Wait, do you mean you can't afford to be quiet?
Well, you can't afford to be quiet as in if you're just the kid sitting in the corner and you're going, people are going to stare at you. And if you don't make a noise after that, well, they're just going to think you're weird. But if you make a noise and then you make a joke, you're not the weird kid. You're the funny kid.
So you became kind of a comedian in a way.
Yeah, and it was terrible. I was given time out constantly, so it didn't necessarily work out for me. But, you know, I think I learned some important things about being the center of attention and how to manage that in a way.
Can you give an example of something you learned about that? It's interesting with someone who's going to become an actor, you know, but how do you manage that? Because you're talking about being the center of attention, but not entirely by choice.
Yeah. Well, the thing that I've worked up to, and this is the journey is more what it is, because I don't think that I was ever good at being the center of attention. I don't think that I ever really wanted to be there. But what I learned slowly but surely was that sometimes you can just be the weird kid, and if people are gonna give you trouble for that, well, that's fine. That's not your problem. That's their problem. But you know, obviously, getting to that point was people going, oh, Jamie's just annoying. Oh, Jamie's just loud. Oh, Jamie just makes noises. And it's not the Tourette's. He's just weird. When in reality, it's this deeply insecure kid who just said something really embarrassing and dumb. And so, well, I'm going to roll with that. I'm going to make the joke. I'm gonna push the bit, commit to the bit, basically. And it made me good at improv. I'm very strong with the yes and, with the picking up at the end of a sentence that I didn't mean to say and continuing it as if it's a sentence that I meant to say.
So I'm guessing that this is part of your journey as an actor, like a really crucial part of it.
Absolutely.
Tell me about, it seems like the ability to, that you're on this journey to become comfortable in your own skin, to be okay with whatever is coming out of your mouth and just relaxing around how other people are going to respond to that. But at the same time, becoming comfortable in someone else's skin.
Yeah, of course.
To be an actor and play a character.
Yeah, no, of course. Well, I mean, there was an important pivotal moment, I think, somewhere in my junior year of college, where I stopped going out to parties, and I stopped really doing anything that wasn't, like, a one-on-one interaction. Obviously, I would go to class, I would go to events that were important to my friends, but I really started picking and choosing the events I was going to. I was no longer forcing myself out into the world and just accepting that, oh, I'm going to make loud noises, because I wasn't happy there. I just thought that maybe if I forced myself to go into that, I'd be happy there. And I think that that applies to acting in a way, because it's you can't force yourself into a character. You need to slowly ease yourself into a character. You need to find where your comfort lies. And with Christopher, you know, he's a very intense character to play. I've had episodes and meltdowns in my life growing up. You know, I have had moments where things become too much and I just go to the floor and I can't control my body. And Christopher has that. And so that's something I can pull from. But I'll put it this way. Jamie a few years ago might have gone with that and been like, I have to be at this level at all times and I would be miserable. But instead, I am able to kind of, I don't know, play into my feelings from Tourette's and use those to access Christopher's feelings.
Without going all the way there.
Exactly. And without compromising myself as a performer and as a person.
What is it that you think, just from your own experience, that people maybe misunderstand about what it means to have Tourette's and then what it's like to have Tourette's?
Well, first off, the most common one is that I get is, I have Tourette's. Isn't that the thing where you swear a lot? Which, even for the people who do swear a lot, that is not the only symptom. I think it is interesting to have that as a touchstone, though, because it is instantly recognizable. But that is coprolalia, which is a symptom that is only shown in 10 to 15% of people with Tourette's. And so that's like the biggest misunderstanding. But also the idea that, oh, if you're ticking, it's because you don't like me or you're uncomfortable around me or like, you know, if I'm doing something weird with my neck or with my head and someone looks at me like, what, is it because I'm making you uncomfortable? It's like, no, I just have these impulses that come through me every once in a while.
And so people assume that it's going to flare up at moments where there's some outside force.
Yeah.
And that they might be responsible for.
Yeah. Or they'll go, oh, you're just doing that all the time. It's weird. And you go, well, you know, it wouldn't be weird if you just ignored it. You know, there are other people who have little tics that, you know, they go, oh, you're always scratching your nose. Or the guy who's always nodding slightly.
Which I'm actually doing right now.
I didn't mean to call you out for that. No. But you know, people who aren't interviewing who do that, you know, and you don't go, oh, you're always slightly nodding at me. But when it's Tourette's, oh, there's a little bit of vocalization. So suddenly I need to stop mid-sentence. And that's always, that I always feel bad too, because I'll be talking to someone and they'll be saying something and I'll be like, and they'll stop. And I'll go, oh, no, don't stop. And they'll continue the sentence. And I'll go, and they'll stop again.
It seems like you've become very comfortable performing the Tourette's symptoms in addition to actually experiencing them.
Yeah, well, I've had such a wide variety of different tics at this point. I mean, there are certain ones that have always come back. That one is a real one that I still do exhibit regularly. I had one in my neck for a long time that kind of moved to my jaw, which is great because it's honestly, it's better to have a tight jaw than whiplash. But for a while, do you know the Thundercats?
Vaguely.
Well, there's a character in it named Snarf who he says, Snarf! And for a long time in high school, I would punctuate sentences by going, Snarf! Snarf! Because there is an episode of Robot Chicken where they really play that up and it became stuck in my head. Or a Family Guy, Butt Scratcher. There's a whole bit about that. And I was incapable of not responding to that. Which, it's funny. And that's the really upsetting thing, is it's actually funny, but it's not funny when you do it every day for like 6 months. But it still is funny to other people who see it for the first time. And then they want to talk about it. And you're like, I just want to move on. Let's just not talk about this.
Yeah, I mean, how old were you when you realized you wanted to be an actor?
Oh, I've wanted to be an actor for as long as I can remember. Both my parents are professional actors who are massive inspirations to me. So it's definitely in my blood. And here's the thing, though. They never pushed me into it. It was very much my choice.
It seems like your experience with Tourette's has been such a tool for you in developing as an actor. Were you ever afraid it would be a stumbling block?
Sure. Oh, absolutely. Well, I think one of the biggest, most important moments was my dad did The Day After Tomorrow, and I got to fly out to, I think it was Vancouver. It was somewhere Canadian. and I got to meet the cast, and one of the cast, his castmates, it was like him and Dennis Quaid were two of the scientists, and the third scientist was Dash Myhawk, who also is an actor with Tourette's, and he was the first actor I had met who had Tourette's syndrome, and he had more visible tics than I did, and it was really wonderful to be able to see someone doing what I thought maybe I might not be able to do, and really get the chance to interact with him and hear that it's possible.
Well, Jamie Sanders, thank you so much for being here. And I know there will be a lot of people in Kansas City seeing you perform soon. But yeah, it's been great to talk to you in the studio.
Thank you for having me.
The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime opens this weekend. Go to kcrep.org for more information. And that is a wrap. You can listen back to today's show, both our conversation about gentrification and this discussion with Jamie Sanders at kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, as part of our Year of Trump coverage here at KCUR, we'll be talking about women inspired to run for office in the last year. That's tomorrow's show. It starts at 10. And you can keep in touch with us on Twitter. We are at KCURCST. This show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Coy Duggar, and Suzanne Hogan. I'm Gina Kaufman, and Up to Date is next. Don't miss it.